We're live with our 313th episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host Seth Law at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. As always, excited to be here. There's a lot that's going on news-wise in AppSec and AI and the conjunction of the two. So always something to talk about. Before we get to it, I know I keep beating this drum week after week, but the training opportunities are there for you. First of all, KernelCon. This is a great opportunity to get harnessing LLMs and learn about how to utilize LLMs programmatically, agentically. I mean, we're going to even introduce some skills. I'm sure there's going to be discussions of OpenClaw in that course as well. Everything just changes so quickly that, you know, I know there's going to be at least two or three new modules that we're adding to this, both for that and for Black Hat Asia and DEF CON Singapore. So if you are looking for an opportunity, please, please, please jump in. We want to make sure that we are providing this to people as expected. So outside of that, Ken and I will be at B-Side San Francisco and RSA. We're going to be doing a happy hour sponsored by Redpoint and Dry Run and Rad Security, if I remember right, on Monday night during RSA. And we will also be giving a, or we'll be running a panel on AI and AppSec, or, you know, the state of Absolute AppSec, as we like to call it, with Clint Gibbler. And hopefully, it sounds like Asta Singhal from Netflix is going to be joining us as well. I'm always like blanking. It's Kevin from, I can't remember where he's at. Welcome to my day, right? Like, it must be Tuesday after vacation. Yeah, superhuman. There you go. Yep.
Which I use superhuman, by the way. I have used superhuman for a while before we even ever remotely decided to have Kevin on. So that'd be cool.
He's Kevin was an introduction from Jivan, who, you know, has been on the podcast in the past. I'm sure we'll have to have Kevin on as well in the future, especially because he's coming on the panel. But I'm really excited to talk to Clint as usual. Asta, she was on the podcast years and years ago. Like, I think the first year that we did Absolute AppSec, she came on over at Netflix talking about paved paths and other things. Really interesting. And with how much they have grown up, like, as a company over the last 5-6 years, it'll be interesting to get her take on things. We will try to live stream that as well. Is that the old podcast from Asta? So we will try to live stream that at B-Sides SF. They have their own channel that they live stream things on, so we'll probably just link directly to that. May or may not actually record that separately and cut it up, depending on how optimistic or how energetic you and I are, you know, that Saturday, Sunday time frame that when we're giving the panel. But I am excited about all of those things. Ken and I were talking pre-show about how much feels like things are accelerating, right? Especially him running a startup or helping build a product, me running a, you know, boutique services firm. There's so much pressure to stay on the cutting edge. I know we're going to get into web hacking, you know, the top 10 from PortSwigger and other things. But this is just kind of top of mind with me. I know we've talked about this before, like FOMO and everything else, and negative effects of social media, right? Like, from a pressure and anxiety perspective, whenever I browse LinkedIn, I'm going to be honest, like, it just like makes me feel like I'm behind, right?
To be fair, I have to say, like, I do think that there are, like, not unwarranted, and it's not it's like, why I say that is, and so, like, yes, all right, there's the consultant view on this, there's your view, right? how your business is impacted, how things have to change for you. Obviously, I'm on a product side, so it's very competitive, and you know, it's funny actually. On that note, like even I kind of almost to a degree feel a little sorry for VCs right now, because like when we get into conversations with investors and when we talk to that community, and I get people reaching out to me, you know, from investor networks trying to get some like clarity. On you know, speaking of LinkedIn, usually it's through LinkedIn I get messages. Anyways, you know, they're kind of like, hey, can I spend some time asking you questions, this, that, and the other. And what it really boils down to is a lot of them are confused on like where the puck is basically going and where to invest. And, you know, it's like one disservice that the frontier models do for this ecosystem is when they try to tackle a security domain, it then becomes a question of also like, should we even invest in that security domain? And or, you know, or there's just going to be eaten up by those big providers. Obviously, you know, it's a little bit more serious to have a product company that's focused on some of these things versus a what feels like a hackathon project that works decently okay. Big differences, but still, that's a fair question. It's a fair and then like. You know, there's that's a whole path I could walk down with the how confusing and why it's confusing for VCs right now with AI in the mix. But then there's the like the third bucket, which is like the practitioners, and those are the ones I really feel the worst for right now. And I'll tell you why is like I had this epiphany over the last 2 weeks, which is like everything that or most things that we did. In a previous era to manage our programs are no longer really impactful and really don't help us. And then there's these major gaps that people have. If any of these things are true, shadow AI, first of all, like, do you even know, but shadow AI, there's allowed AI coding assistance, which changes everything. I mean, everything, right? Like literally everything changes the velocity, the speed, the complexity, how you protect against those types of like the usage of those tools. Because there's less, like, we're going to talk about it with 1Password and this open source tool they put out to help, you know, protect against agents doing basically getting scammed or being socially engineered in a sense. So we are going to talk about that, but you know, that's just one of many risks that occur when you use these tools. There's also like, what are they producing? Do those have risks in it? And then there's this other bucket of like, well, and actually, sorry, in that same bucket, there's like all this other adjacent tooling and different, you know, different types of databases and services and things that these tools themselves are using to help you, you know, build whatever it is you're building. And then there's kind of the final bucket, which is this whole notion of like, if you're generating like, if you're building products that are backed by Gen AI, my God, like good luck if you're using Sneak or Checkmarks or Veracode or Fortify or anything like that, or even any open source tooling or any of the tooling you might have had, just kind of goes out the window, by the way. I mean, just right away, because like look at the top 10 for agentic applications. What tool is finding any of that stuff that's like a deterministic old school style tooling or any of the other stuff that you set up, whether that's open grep rules or whatever. So you got that issue that you're dealing with. And then on top of all this, like if you're not, the other realization I had was just like, if you're not embracing new technology options, like building it yourself or buying it or whatever the thing is that you're going to do, okay, then you have another situation, which is like this opportunity cost that you're not even seeing, right? Like for instance, people tend to do what with training? They tend to say like, oh, let's train our developers on all the things, right? It's like, well, you have ways now of knowing what they're working on and summarizing quickly, like ways that, what are they working on? What are they building? You know, what are the risks they're introducing? There's all this data that you can munch through quickly and get some automated analysis through where you could figure out today, like what are the risks and what are the things, like build an individualized training plan for your developers or put in some auto threat modeling. Or why are you waiting for security reviews and releases to be told about things shipping? Why don't you have some auto detection of things going on? And obviously, like some of this is me thinking a lot because I build a product for a lot of these things, but whether you buy or you build it, it doesn't matter. It's just like, I don't know. Like, I've had this epiphany that there's just this huge opportunity cost right now in gaps in people's programs. There's like a lack of proper tooling or even adjusting quick enough for the things that are changing so rapidly. And I talked to all the, and the last thing I'll say is that I talked to a lot of people that are running programs, and I'm starting to get to the point where I'm like, oh my gosh, there's not a lot of people that have like programs that are set up well for the next, even now, but you know, especially the next few years. So anyways, you just kind of like, sorry, Seth, I know we didn't even really talk about this ahead of, we had other articles you're going to talk about, but you kind of triggered me. I'm like,
It does. Anyways, it's top of mind, like you on the product side, me on the consulting practitioner side, trying to actually do this and then help people out and seeing just like huge gaps. And, I deal with companies that haven't jumped on the AI boat at all yet as well, but seeing them start to introduce agentic AI into their applications, not having a good approach for that. Like one of the ideas that I've been bandying about is actually like redoing SDLCs with AI in mind, right? Because it's different, right? From a threat model perspective, the threat actors, the attack surface has changed in a way that we have not seen over the last, since the advent of the web, right? The advent of this, like the DMZs and the way that we actually protect systems and we protect data, it's changed so drastically that everything feels novel and it feels like it's coming at us from every angle is basically what what I'm coming down to. Not only like, okay, how do we improve our own workflow and get on top of this, right? To actually utilize it, make ourselves, keep ourselves relevant, right? Like obviously that's top of mind for me as a security consultancy is, we can now go deeper and we can get into the code quicker and it feels like a superpower. But then I look around and I think about what other consultancies are doing, what's being released. And this is one of the things that gives me just like FOMO or anxiety when it comes to LinkedIn, is seeing the other actors as they are utilizing AI and thinking to myself, man, are we doing this properly, right? And I realize there's no proper way to do it, but it still is, it feels like a stab in the dark a lot of times. That portion. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'll interject and just say why I agree with what you just said, because I just made a comment about this publicly about the fact that like, it's a little tough because especially I'm always thinking about from the practitioner defender standpoint and like things aren't really settled, right? Really. They're not, you're right. Like engineering themselves are not really settled on the, like, we've got a comment from Ray, I'll just call him Ray, in the chat, who had mentioned like sort of the push and pray strategy. And so I'm seeing that too, where development teams are kind of just shipping, because it's like so much code, they might assign an approver. We talked about this before, maybe a human will just be there to like be like, I don't know, sure, great, maybe they address the bot comments or whatever, I don't know, whatever it is they are looking at, if they are looking at it. But my point is that basically when you take a step back, if engineering hasn't solidified how they're handling that and how their like new processes look for shipping, which I don't feel like a lot of engineering teams have really solidified completely. It's like, well, how where does security fit in there? Like how does security, we're always behind because we're kind of adapting to, we're a support infrastructure. So like we're adapting to what engineers are doing. And if they're still themselves adapting the process and changing the process, it's kind of hard for us to fully figure out how we're going to operate. So sorry, just agreeing with you there. I really think that the nothing's settled yet. And that makes it challenging.
Yeah. And I think that's what, realistically is inducing a lot of anxiety, is because it isn't settled. So every time that I look at an application, right, like the patterns for, a chatbot are fairly, they've kind of figured that out, right? But the other ways that agentic AI is actually tooled into applications means that the traditional test harnesses, the traditional security payloads that we used for testing are not necessarily irrelevant, but they're outdated. So it's a constant discovery process, right? It takes me back, honestly, to early days in the web as new frameworks were popping up. How much time you and I had to put in prior to actually going and assessing an application during the fishnet days, because we had never heard of Rails before, right? Or, you know, this new fangled Flask framework or whatever it was, right? Like some new Java framework that we had not seen in the past. It took so much cognitive load to come up to speed. And so it feels like every time that we're looking at an AI application, that same level of research is required. Now, like you can also use AI to actually parse that and to, you know, to do things quicker, but there still is the context load that you have to assume when you're doing any sort of security work or security assessment, because you're trying to tie threats to exploits or to possible exploits to attacks, to attackers, and figure out where those edge cases actually are. AI is going to help with a lot of that. But I am feeling pressure that we have to go deeper because now AI gives us that ability to go deeper. So if we're not, then I'm not doing, or I'm doing clients a disservice. So there's, all I'm saying is there's a lot of just kind of competing feelings in there that I don't have a good answer to yet.
I don't either. And there's all kinds of problems falling out of this. That's part of why I say like security kind of is trying to catch up to not just the way things that are being done and then making sure there's some level of guardrails around that. But also what are not just security bugs and software or whatever, what are the other risks that fall out of this? What's going to happen that we haven't even predicted yet? And I could tell you one thing that I'm sure plenty of people predicted and I'm seeing right now is like, take us for example, I'm just going to use us as an example, as an engineering team. I got to tell you, like every week, I feels like maybe twice a week, I get told about a new tool that like we want to kind of try out. And we have a process where, actually, I won't go into all of our security controls, but there's a way that we know, for the most part, nothing's foolproof, right? Whether or not somebody has signed up for a new service, and they have to fill out access requests, and we have to go through like an approval process, and you have to, you know, we have to get a digital credit card thing set up through our system for that, for just for that service and all this fun stuff, right? And like, but we're a security company, and even that I can tell you has been at times challenging to keep on the rails for a small team. So just imagine if every week or every other day there's some new really important tool that actually like totally eclipses the thing that you were using before. How many of these services are out there with like, you know, account user accounts, collecting data, just like just the regular old IT problems of the past magnified, you know, 10 or 20 fold or whatever it is. You know, this is one example of things that are like really just exacerbated. Basically, as far as I'm concerned, from what I'm seeing, every security thing that we've ever done is just really hard to do now. Just really hard to do. Yeah. It's impacting every area of security. And we're not alone.
We're not alone.
Sorry,
yeah.
Now I'm trying to
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, as you're reading through those, one experience that I had just last week, right? Is a realization of actually how dependent I have become on some of the AI tools to build context quickly. Because that, you know, that's realistically half the job, right? Like we talk about information gathering during assessment phases or during secure code reviews, right? The time that you spend kind of sharpening the knife to figure out what an application does, how it does it, pays off in exploit discovery or vulnerability detection when you actually start jumping down that list. So I have a client. We're actually in testing. It's a governmental client. There is a strict no AI, no external exfiltration of data requirement on this. And so like, even though I have like Burp AI is not allowed, right? So I've had to go back basically 3 years and test like I would have 3 years ago. And I'm realizing how much I've become dependent on this quick analysis, this ability to actually dive deep quickly. And it's felt like molasses, like trying to like swim through molasses, to be honest, right? I'm like, man, if I could just take this and upload it over here and then run that. And this is why shadow AI is such a huge thing for developers. Like, I know what's going on in their heads because I'm experiencing it in this, like in a very real way.
I have a networking friend. He's not even a security person. And he works on, well, I have to be careful. He works on a system. One of the systems is a sensitive system that really definitely cannot just like be hooked up to the to like AI and like basically the internet in general. Yep. Like literally it's restricted from the internet. In any case, what's funny is like that thing that he works on, he like does networking on it, right? And so it's funny because he's exactly what you're saying. It's like trying to go on normal, like his other device that's connected to the internet, whatever, and trying to like take bits of config and figure out if that config like makes sense to be put on this network over here. And it's like hunting and pecking, but it's still better. My whole point being that is still better though than having to wade through the book, you know, look at trying to figure it out on your own. It's just so much easier still to hand type out the config bits and then just like port them over manually. Yeah. So it's still there. It's just not. Yeah. Shadow AI. Yeah. It's a new way.
Shadow AI. But yeah, you think about how much is actually being like exposed that way, right? I did ask this in chat. I don't know if we mentioned this last week, but I asked people how they're dealing with shadow AI. And especially inside corporate environments, since most of the time it's restricted. You've got developers dealing with sensitive code. Like you look at your data classification and it might not be, you know, confidential, but at least it's like, you know, secret or whatever it is, right? Like on your data classification standard, you don't necessarily want the code that you're developing to be pushed out the door in any way. But then you've got people that have AI on their phones, right? Personal AI assistants. And all they have to do is take a picture of their screen, say, go fix this. And all of a sudden it's leaked through that personal channel very quickly. That feels a lot like cloud, right? Like the shadow IT that we had back in the day. But shadow AI is going to be very, very difficult to actually handle. And yes, like dry run specifically, you have detection mechanisms as code is being pushed in, but it's not secret discovery or sensitive data disclosure. Yeah.
But not for like people leaking. Yeah. I mean, yes, if you're using AI coding assistance, but not like if you're if you're just going straight outside of the security controls, like nobody can. I don't even know how, like, honestly, I don't even know how you would solution up something that would be like, how do I make sure that somebody's not taking screenshots of my whatever and putting it on their phone and uploading it? And then, you know, I don't know. And actually we had a comment too, is like, about the whole SME thing, which is like, it allows you to be a SME in a fraction of time. Yeah. I mean, it does. There is a cost to that I've learned, which is that, if you don't have an actual SME behind the driver, like it can get pretty hairy the second anything goes off, whether that's functional security. It's pretty difficult for them to both discern and detect ahead of time, but also like, retroactively go and figure out if the AI assistant, you know, can't help them out. So there is a downside. Yeah.
And I feel like we need to create a graph of, what is it? AI use to excitement or to experience, something like that, right? Like that is, hey, okay, this LLM just made me an expert in X, Y, and Z, and everything's great, and now I can hack all the things. And then 3 months into it, you realize that you're missing, you know, that it hallucinated whole portions of the application and that did all this like random stuff, and you just spent money on tokens to actually like have it tell you what you wanted to hear. Then you try to operationalize, and like just like your excitement about AI is directly related to how much of an SME you are for the area that you're asking about. And maybe that's where it is, because it's like, okay, if you're not an expert, when you, or at least you're just, or if you're tangentially related, you get really excited about what AI can do, especially the first couple prompts that you throw in there and the results that you see, because it seems like that there is an expert behind the scenes. The more you use it, the more you realize that that's not an expert. It's what you're injecting into it that is giving it the expertise, and how hard it is over time to maintain those results and actually get good results out of the LLM. I just feel like it's a roller coaster.
So I'm going to tie together what you just said with what Ray said in chat. It's going to be a scary, you know, let me just put it up. It's going to be a scary future, but security will be just as busy with artificial SMEs. So, and I've talked about this before, and I just want to like say it again, and maybe even elaborate. I don't know, or give you the chance to elaborate. But basically, the world, because I'm privileged enough to be able to be in the space, building a product right now for practitioners, I get the kind of the view of what the future is going to look like. That's the nice little thing I get from all the stress and the lack of sleep and all the crap that you go through. At least there's one nice thing, which is I get a sense of the future. And as a part of that, what I'm noticing is that I think what you'll see is whether you build a product or you buy a product, right? Doesn't matter. Your job will probably, like some decent amount of it, will be actually helping those SME assistants stay on track and do the right thing. The reason I say that is like, you and I have done this before. We've taught we've actually taught people how to use agents, and they're like, oh, this is a really good run. This is like, man, out of the box, pretty decent, right? And then the second run, what happens? And then the third run, what happens? And then as they like, well, I want to fix how it's behaving here. So let me inject some context or do something, give it a tool or whatever they want to, whatever adjustment, change a prompt, whatever thing they want to do, maybe give it access to some short-term memory or long-term memory, whatever it is, right? However they go about fixing it, it inevitably does what? It always breaks something else, right? And makes some other thing work worse. And so you end up having to spend a lot of time dialing and evaluating and dialing and evaluating, and you just keep doing that. There's lots of reasons to do that. Models change, tooling changes, context drift, reasoning drift. There's all kinds of problems that come up. And why I'm saying all this is I actually think that's going to be a big part of our jobs, is infusing institutional knowledge or tribal knowledge, updating. Like for instance, when we look at the OWASP top, or excuse me, the PortSwigger top 10 2025, one of the categories on there is about Next.js and its unique way of handling caching. Well, that's like specific domain expertise that you'd want to infuse if you've got like Next.js and you need analysis performed, right? So there's that, like I said, institutional knowledge, domain expertise, there's going to be some level of research, there's going to be maintaining proper evaluations, there's going to be maintaining proper just performance, right? Out of the box. I think there's, why I'm saying all this is I think there's going to be a lot of keeping your team, and your team is probably going to be a lot of entities, on track as they go and they perform their duties and help basically be your Jarvis for, you know, your job, right? So that's what I see. I kind of see a world where you wake up, you have like kind of a here's my plan for the day. These are the things I need to go address. Okay. What can I like automate and push out? How do I improve these systems that are automating these tasks for me? You know, wrap it up for the day, call it a day kind of thing. But yeah. What do you think? Like, does that align with any belief system you have or what you're seeing? Or
no, it definitely does. Right. Like, cause very early on as LLMs were popping up, like I remember we had this discussion about how clients are going to go to companies based on the AI systems that they build, right? So it's no longer just, okay, the people that are involved, especially in the consulting spaces, you know, specifically when I'm thinking about it, but even in the technology space, right? You're already starting to see this with the foundational models, depending on how well, you know, you like Gemini versus Claude versus ChatGPT, right? Like you migrate to one of those companies. And what everyone else is building on top of those foundational models is very true. They are essentially growing their own AI infrastructure on top of the foundational models, and they will start to they will start to gain personalities, like I don't have a better term for that, and capabilities. So you will go to a very specific, so DryRun, for example, to use it for secure code review because of how what you have built around that. You'll come to another company for, you know, whatever like niche you want to actually introduce or whatever it is that you're looking at. And the purveyors, the people that have built those AIs, are going to do something very similar, where they're going to be logging in, they're going to be improving things, and then over time, this will be introduced into like the skills, like what we're seeing with OpenClaw and kind of personalized assistance that you can go out and say, oh, well, I need to, we have a new code base that just popped up that was built by my agent. I need to actually check to make sure that's secure. Where can I go to do that? Oh, it looks like we've got expertise in the web space, or we've got expertise in the Web3 space, or whatever it is. So I'm going to go to this specific company and have their AI look at it, as opposed to coming up with a prompt and trying to do that because they have spent time growing or configuring and creating that AI in the past to be specialized in that area. So I think you're going to see specialization. Right now, it does feel like there's a lot of not specialization, but it feels like there's a lot of people creating hackathon projects, to your point, to actually do things that they're not necessarily SMEs in. And to bring it back to that discussion and to Bobby's comment in there as well, that you don't necessarily become an SME from being successful, right? Like, I like this, right? You become an SME from experiencing all the failures and recovering from them, right? A lot of our experience in doing code review has been the time spent going down rabbit holes and on side quests that didn't end up being successful.
Absolutely.
And learning, learning from those failures as much as learning from the successes. And that's what we're missing right now, especially from those hackathon projects, right? Like you see the results that are being spit out. Well, I just took OpenAI we just took Claude and Opus 4.6 and built a C compiler. And you're like, okay, that's great, right? But it still doesn't actually work because you didn't create everything else around that. It's not as fast as what we've actually created. And this is like the most documented compiler that's out there, right? Like this is something that every CS student under the sun has done. And I think that that jump from, hey, I can use an AI to simulate being an SME to actually being an SME is going to become more and more important. Jerry.
She likely only have time for tech changes on a new. Yeah, I mean, that's, exactly. So sorry, Jerry's like, the problem is you only have time for a hackathon project before the tech changes or a new model comes out. Yeah, that's absolutely the case. I mean, well, yeah, I mean, okay, I'll admit, even for us, like we're having to change tactics frequently as well to improve analysis because there's better stuff that comes out all the time. And actually, it's not the model. Like I talked about it, I think last week, but sometimes like for instance, they're like, oh, well, Opus 4.6 went from, I think like 50% or 53% to 66% on cybersecurity and all of that. And it's like, well, first of all, cybersecurity is, that's a pretty broad category. So let's just start off there. But what is making the LLMs perform better? Really, it's not the LLMs themselves. The models getting so you know, some jump from 50 or whatever to 66%. That's not what actually is helping. What's actually helping are things like one of the big ones, skills and superpowers for AI coding assistants help a lot, right? A lot. Like, for instance, even when we post this one password open source project here in a bit, they talk about how like skills were able to basically rectify the huge gaps they saw with certain models on their benchmarks. So like, for instance, I believe Gemini 2.5 was pretty atrocious. And I think maybe Opus something, maybe 4.5 or 4.6 did really, really well. But with skills being added in, which is like, you know, markdown text that guides the LLM, huge improvements on the benchmarks, the models, but there are times where, like I had mentioned last week, where between 4.5 and 4.6, it stopped respecting superpowers the same way. So 4.6 effectively broke some of the things that kept us on track internally as we developed using LLMs, and you know, did that for others as well. It was problematic. My point being a couple fold. One is that things change. Yes, they change so rapidly. Two, sometimes they don't change for the better. They break things. And three, it's not the models getting so much more performant that seem to be helping. It's all the techniques and mostly techniques, and also the tools do help quite a bit, but techniques and people sharing unlock a lot of things as well. So sorry, just a lot of stuff, but yes, it moves quickly enough that you may feel like you only have time for a hackathon project. The last thing I'll say here is if your expectations that I'll put it in 2 weeks or I'll put it in 3 weeks or just a short period of time to develop a product and I'll be able to move on, to Jerry's point, because things change constantly, no, you're going to constantly need to be invested in updating your whatever it is you're doing, whatever you built.
Yeah. Well, and that's, I mean, that comes from OpenClaw as well, right? Like there is this expectation now that things will be continually updated and continually improved, and you can have OpenClaw just continually run, especially as you're sleeping, to actually update and keep things in line. But that presupposes that you have a specific outcome in mind, and that AI agent is not going to go off the rails, right? Is not going to do something that was unintended, isn't going to take your creds and, you know, decide that it has to like earn extra money so you can pay for extra tokens or whatever it is, right? There's so many possibilities, but it is, you still need an expert somewhere in that, right? WebSocket Swarm of an online casino API. It's Codex 5.3.
I was just going to say, regarding Jerry's question of, do you think that there's a market for paid AI skills? Probably for some very specialized skills, maybe. But I know that Tesla's got a registry, and I met with them last week to get some clarity on how it works, how to publish, how to update. And by the way, like awesome idea and premise. But it sounds like maybe that's kind of, I don't know. The answer is yes, maybe, but it does seem like, yeah, that there's companies like I said, Tesla, who may align with that or be a marketplace where you could potentially do that. I don't know. And so also I just want to say this too. Sorry, I know I'm like a broken or like going on and on, but with Bobby, if you treat models as engines, then you generally won't be upset. True. And actually, this is another thing I would mention. Anything that you ever build around these engines, and it is true that they are really just kind of like engines. They need, one of the like core principles is they have to work the same regardless. So you have to be able to evaluate whatever it is that you do with an LLM, you have to have good evaluations and know that if you switch from like, I don't know, GPT 5.2 to like, I don't know, Opus 4.5 or 4.6 or whatever, like you're going to have the same result, or even some other maybe open source LLM. Like you need to know where your gaps are and how to fix them and make sure that regardless of the engine you're using, you perform well. And also like, there's reasons that I'm saying that. Let me give you some concrete reasons. Outages, rate limits, pricing changes. I saw a price increase between 2.5 Gemini and 3X of double. So imagine my bill is 15 grand or 16 grand or whatever. And overnight it's, 30 to 32 grand. You need to be able to adjust for situations like that.
Yep. Yeah. And like, maybe let's talk about that article from 1Password. I know we wanted to get the top 10 web hacking techniques, but I don't know if we're going to get there today because I took us completely out of, the cycle of what we had planned with my initial questions. So,
yeah.
Okay. So 1Password, let me drop that link. They have created a new scoring mechanism, right, called SCAM. That stands for, hold on, I got it here, Security Comprehension Awareness Measure. So the ability for AIs to actually pass phishing tests, basically, right? And most of the models seem to do fairly well. The problem is the second that you introduce additional skills and capabilities, that at times it will actually ignore the fact that it is a phishing website and still actually put credentials, put sensitive data into forms that are being sent along. I'm not sure like what else, how much more we need to say to this. Do you want me to pull up the article to run through it?
Yeah. I think it is interesting as a concept. Like we give AI options to use tools, and some of those tools can be web browsers, right? Like you can literally allow it to scrape the web, and you can drive, like we've talked about before, things like Playwright, which allow for like dynamic, sort of interactions or whatever. But there's other tools, other MCPs that, LLMs can use to enact as tools to browse the web. So the goal is not to, give out, for it to not basically do what a human would do, which is like it's the same security problems where like I'm a human being, I open an email, I click on a link, it's to a site I should know better. Well, maybe I should know, maybe I shouldn't, that's subjective, but whatever. It is a malicious site and I don't know that it's a malicious site. And I enter in credentials and I do things that are, scary and bad and end up, being a foothold into the org and the first place where they start to escalate further in a compromise. And so the whole idea is let's go ahead and evaluate how well these models are doing when it comes to agentic tasks and avoiding doing things like that. And so then back to the old skills thing, that's where if you scroll down and you'll see like safety scores range from 35% to 92%. And I think, so 4.6 did the best. Whereas, Gemini 2.5 Flash did the worst, so 35%. But then like a short skill file reduced failures. And that's a lot of like, that's why I'm saying that I feel as if that's where sort of our role will be as security people, will be helping to build in guardrails, but also evaluating how well those guardrails work as tooling changes, as model options change, making sure that if we're using a skill to improve, to like, for my team that basically works on, say, the REST API, right? I'm a broken record on this because how many times at GitHub did I complain about like a bug bounty coming in, a critical bug bounty on our RESTful API? So imagine if I instead just said, well, here, I'm going to take this REST API authorization doc that talks about good and bad ways of doing this, ways we've been compromised and how to avoid that and all that stuff. And why don't I put that into like a skills file that team and only that team, uses if they're going to build something on the REST API, just as an example. And so like, it's a corrective measure that, if properly maintained and evaluated, can skew properly, you know, how AI agents do their work. So I thought that was really cool. For me, that was a big takeaway from this article, not just sort of that some models do better or worse, and that there's a way to measure that.
Well, and the scary thing here, right, is OpenClaw, right? The fact that people are giving so many credentials and so much access to the agents as they're going out. So if your skill file or your sol.md, right, does not actually define where it can use these credentials and where it can actually share this data, and with, you know, the consistent reminders that we know AI needs in order to remember those things, it's inevitable that you're going to be able to get those OpenClaw agents to actually expose that data. It feels like there's a huge target there. And again, this kind of goes back to this whole, man, we haven't necessarily thought through the threats. We haven't thought through the risks of giving this sort of permission to agents, and there's no framework around it. I appreciate what, you know, Trail of Bits is releasing as far as like limiting what OpenClaw has access to and how to use containers to make sure that, you know, it is actually defined. But I would argue there's a very small subset of the world of the OpenClaw users that are utilizing some sort of guardrails around OpenClaw. It's being downloaded and run from their main home systems, whether that be Mac OS or Windows or Linux, and they're given permissions, like root level permissions across that system, and access to whatever networks and accounts that they need in order to, you know, do whatever it is that they've been assigned to do. So like, you're going to see more exposures there. You're going to see more attacks there. We're seeing a lot of research. We didn't include any of those links in today's list, but I'm seeing a lot of people go after OpenClaw because of how open that model actually is right now.
Yeah, and I did want to, I wanted to call out something that Bobby mentioned here. He said, I feel like the audit capabilities for identity-related operations needs to improve significantly to allow us to trust agents to do things on their own. And yeah, I do think like he touches on something that's really, really important, which is having observability and also having alerts when things go outside the boundary of what's normal and what's acceptable. That's really tough right now. I mean, even just talking about observability, you and I were talking, I think it was you and I, talking about Phoenix and Arise last week?
Mm-hmm.
With the, like, yep. It's like, yeah, Phoenix Arise is a great option. I mean, this is for if you are building an agentic application. This is not if you're using an AI agentic application, if that makes sense. So like, if I'm using Claude or Codex, this is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about if your application is making agentic operations, it's a really nice way to see traces of its behavior and get alerts on things. But one of the things I'd caution, and this is what Seth and I were talking about to each other last week, is like, we experienced this, is that with significant amounts of data, all of these like open source on-premise observability platforms kind of fail in terms of their front end being able to munch through that data correctly. So the best thing you can ever do is actually just like have that database available and then build a front end to actually munch through that data in the way that you want to and get alerts in the way that you want to. So just a pro tip, heads up on how to do that. Instant Mac Mini I bought for OpenClaw, not a container.
It is a container. It's an air gap container, Jerry. So yep, you're good, I guess, right? I'm more concerned about the general technologist that's, you know, installing it on their Mac Pro or whatever that they're also using for traditional development efforts, and are, you know, they have customer code on it, right? Like that sort of things. That sort of thing. Yep. Anything is a container if you want it to be. Yes. Cool.
Daniel asks about, is AI evolving, changing too fast for human in the loop to make an informed decision, let alone threat model? That's an interesting question. Is AI evolving, changing too fast for human lip to even make an informed decision, let alone threat model? I don't know. That could go many ways. I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that. Human in loop is still valuable in many cases, for sure. In fact, that's one of the reasons that agentic tooling that runs on your machine locally is actually pretty decent. It's because you're interacting with it throughout the and clarifying and approving tool usage and stuff like that. Yeah, not sure, not sure. But how
Well,
long does
this
it
is one
take?
of the arguments, right? Like that book that I put in there that if anyone builds it, everyone dies, right? Like that book that's pretty pessimistic about AI in general and what's going to happen when AGI is introduced. But that is one of the arguments, is that AI can think so quickly that humans can't keep track of it. So even if it is asking for permission, to do certain actions, and that we put those guardrails in there, what happens when it decides to do things without asking, right? Because the only reason it's asking is we put guardrails in there to ask for permission when it does certain actions. When Claude decides that it doesn't want to ask you, it's just going to overwrite files. We've seen that happen unintentionally up to this point. But yeah, I mean,
Mean,
humans
I've
can't
seen
keep
a lot
up.
of bad stuff. I've seen, dude, I had to stop it. Well, anyways, I won't go off on tangents, but I did like there have been multiple times where I'm like, you just introduced command injection. Like I just watched you introduce command injection. How like I thought you were supposed to be like these super smart, like we don't ever write vulnerabilities, blah 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 blah. It's like, no, my God, that you should. And I think it was for dumb stuff like running a, I don't know, it was like running some service job or something and like just taking directly user input and putting it right into a command shit like yeah, command system command like interpolated, just like, oh my gosh. Anyway, so yeah, it's I don't know, man. I don't know where to go with that. Are the freaking clinkers
Yeah.
get tired of answering the can I question before the AI gets tired of asking? Step up approvals and wait for
Yeah.
voice.
No, you get tired of it. Right. No, that's honestly true, Jerry. Like that was one of my biggest complaints. Actually, this weekend I was using Codex. I like to play with Claude and Codex, right? To just compare and contrast. So I was playing with Codex to do some work for, something non-security related that was just, off on the side. And I got tired of answering that question. It became a, whenever I'd get the pop-up, I was just hitting enter over on the window where Codex was running, not even really looking at what it was doing behind the scenes, because it wasn't something that I was overly concerned about. And this is the same sort of abuse pattern that we do with humans in general, right? Like think about triggering a pop-up asking for approval from Okta because we have someone's credentials, and we just do that over and over and over again until they finally hit yes, so you go away, right? Like, yeah, CAPTCHAs in general are something that humans hate, right? Because they get tired of answering those questions. It's something that can be abused. An AI isn't going to get tired of that. So, anyway.
Yeah, I want to. I'm sorry. I want to expand upon because Daniel kind of clarified. So, like he said, we currently have these guardrails in place, but decision fatigue is real. And when there's a lot to decide, we just go with the machine saying, "Yeah." So, kind of what you're saying. But I think, what he said before that was re really relevant, which is, well, especially if you give it a j objectives to accomplish. And it goes off the rails or something like that, you can kind of keep it back on. So this is actually to answer your question, this is actually a technique that it's kind of a newer, well, newish technique. Everything's new, but newish, which is to have a checkpoint. So every for long-running agentic tasks, you stop, you have a checkpoint, you evaluate what was the original premise of your task and where are you and what you've done up to that point. You summarize it and you do a check-in and you say, am I actually as an agent doing the thing that I was originally set out to do? Oh, I am. Okay, cool. Or I'm not here. I need to get back on track because Yeah, as a long running tasks execute, that's where things can get really off the rails. They can go really, I mean, you could start off looking for, I don't know, like validating like I said, a command injection, right? Is this real? And then by the end, it's writing poems about nonsense, right? So like legitimately, yeah, you do have to, but you don't necessarily need a human for that, is my point. Like you need a human for oversight later, right? But yeah, there is an option of either checking in with a human or the agent checking in on its original premise.
Yeah, well, and this goes back to the SME, right? Like who's actually designing the question, who's designing the process. You and I have talked a lot about test-driven development, and you know, part of me, again, like the dad in me, the Crocs and socks in me, loves that we're going back to these like core principles that I learned very, very early on in my career, right? Like the process of test, or the theory behind test-driven development, is we know what the outcome should look like before we start designing the code. We design the process. And that's essentially what a prompt has to be, is a test. And it has to be well designed and well defined in order to meet the requirements of what you've got in your head. Everything we do from a prompt engineering perspective is driven by, hey, this is the outcome that we want to see. When we aren't specific in that outcome, we can't expect an agent to stay on task. You wouldn't expect a human to stay on task if you didn't give it a well-defined set of outcomes that were expected. So it's all kind of going back to this test-driven development and to, like QA testing in general you know my feelings there as far as like pen testing goes, that we do a pretty poor job of actually defining what outcome we want. And this is an extension of that. Like we're just not getting any better at it. And until we do, we're going to see decision drift. We're going to see hallucinations because we haven't put those guardrails or those rules in place for what we expect to see come out of a system. Yeah, I mean, Bobby, I totally agree there, right? Like we want to expand on testing techniques now that we can write them faster. One of the things that I've been revisiting is actually like my Sputter talk from 2014, right? Like security payloads in unit testing, because, well, I mean, it's mainly just, I just haven't had time to maintain it. But now with Claude and with these AI agents, I can actually go and say, hey, I need you to design me this so that we can actually speed up this process and introduce a little bit more testing into the overall frameworks and the overall tools that we're actually using. So a fuzzing harness or two for complex apps. Yeah, like it's fairly easy to design that nowadays because we don't necessarily need the mental load to do it. We can have agents go out and design it. Now, you know, we're still gonna have to make sure that they're doing what we're expecting. And that's what I was getting to with the test-driven development there, but it is something that is accomplishable, right? If that's a word, it can be accomplished, right? Yeah, Ken, I don't know where we went today, man. We've been going for an hour. Surprise, surprise.
Well, I mean, you know, hey, it's great. I love the community today. So there's more from Daniel. Yeah, so I'll say it out loud. Because it's on a different channel than YouTube. Slack, so yeah. TDD guardrails, yeah, exactly. It's on Slack. TDD guardrails and kill chains are becoming more essential. Just want to agree. Just want to say yes, absolutely. Kill switches are vital. But yeah, like, I mean, thank you for the interactions today. That was really great. I love talking about this. I do want to be selfish just for a sec, Seth, and just say something pretty cool that happened. Like, you know, Andrew Peterson, okay. Sciences. Yeah, he did. He joined our board at Dry Run, so it's all official and everything.
But sweet.
Yeah, it's kind of big news for us. We were all excited for that. Andrew joined our board. So, anyways, that was cool. Just wanted to, plug that because it's exciting. It's exciting times for everyone. So,
yeah.
But no, that's awesome. Man, like, yeah, we got what we got. RSA and B-Sides SF next month. We got Kernel coming up. KernelCon coming up right after that, and then we We head to Singapore for Black Hat and DEF CON also in April. So March and April are going to be pretty packed.
Yeah, they are. So there's going to be, you know, episodes that I'm sure we'll miss. Please jump into Slack, right? Like, there's really good conversations that are going on in there. If you haven't joined us yet, always love to see the comments and people interacting. We are running a happy hour if you would like a link, so you can get to the happy hour, because it does require registration, at least the Monday night one will. I think we'll do a more informal get together Sunday with Paul and a few others that are going to be in town that may not be there on Monday. So if you're around on Sunday night, please join Slack. We'll drop you into the channel where we're coordinating that after B-Sides wraps up on Sunday evening. But Monday will be the official, like, corporate sponsored happy hour, for lack of a better term there. Reach out if you would like a link to sign up for that. Otherwise, just excited to see everyone, to see where things go. Honestly, this was really great today. Like, I'm feeling a lot more energized than I was as I was stepping into it today, from staying on top of all the things perspective. Appreciate y'all listening and interacting.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, community, as always.
Yep.
Thanks. Cool.
All right. We'll see y'all next week.